So welcome everybody. So this is the last talk, last Friday night talk for the year 2021. No. 20, what year are we to? I don't know, 2023. Okay, so the last talk for year 2023 for the Friday nights. Okay, so I'll be back at Crow's Nest next Wednesday, and that will be the last one there. And we'll be doing our Christmas retreat starting following weekend, like weekend after this one. And we will be starting again with the talks in January. So please check the Lokanta website for the start dates on that, because you can't expect me to remember what they are. Okay. We're here in Parramatta on the land of the Burramattagal people of the Darug Nation, and we pay respects to the elders past, present and emerging, and our gratitude for them for their custodianship of the land for such a long period of time. For today, we will do some chanting and some meditation and some Dhamma talk. What do you think? Sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay, excellent. Sorry, got a computer bug. My computer just told me there was a bug. Do we still have sound? Sound still good? Okay. Do let me know if the sound drops out. Occasionally the sound on this computer seems a bit buggy. The software seems a bit buggy. So if it does drop out, please let me know. Okay. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhamma saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Itipiso bhagava arahaṃ sammāsambuddho. Vidya charana sampanno sugato lokavidu. Anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi. Sattha deva manusana buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandhitiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko kachatam veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho.
Ujjupāṭhipanno bhagavato sāva saṅgho Nyāyapāṭhipanno bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho Samīcipāṭhipanno bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho Yadidam chatari purisa yugani Artha purisa pungala Esa bhagavato savaka sangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo Niyo anutaram punyaketa lokasati.
We've reached the end of another week, close to the end of another year. And we have the time to stop. It's the week end, ending of things. And in Buddhism, the ending of things is nice. Desanguupasamosuko. When they end, it's nice. That's literally what that means. Desanguupasamosuko. So we tend to have this problem that we like to fix things. And we think that by, for example, adding more technology to a problem is going to make it simpler. And sometimes, sure. But the spiritual approach, or at least the dhammic approach, is always to see, well, what can I take away? Welcome. Welcome, come in. Just in time. Missed the boring bits. Very good. So from a spiritual point of view, we like to allow things to end. It's nice. It's peaceful. So why does it seem to us like this is such a hard thing to do? Think of how many times that you've thought to yourself, oh, meditation's hard. Or how many times people have said to you, meditation's hard. You say, oh, this is hard. It's a struggle. And we use a lot of this language to talk about meditation. Oh, I have to struggle in meditation. All of these things. Why, though? Why do we have to struggle to let things end? Things end all by themselves. We literally don't have to do anything. All our problems will come to an end. Just think about that for a moment. Every worry that you've ever had, right? Let's say that you're worried right now. Okay, you have a worry in your mind and you think, oh, worry. But just think, every worry that you've had in your whole life, up to this one, is all finished. That means thousands of worries, probably millions of worries are all gone and only one remains. Pretty good, isn't it? It's not too bad, actually. Imagining you feel afraid. All of your fears are gone. Only one is here. If you feel depressed, all of your sad emotions have gone and only one is here. What's going to happen to that one? Is that one going to be different? Is that going to be the only one that just stays there forever? I don't think so. I think it's just going to disappear like all the others. So why do we worry so much about worrying? Why are we so anxious about anxiety? Why do we think that it's our problem to go and fix all our problems? These things will come to an end. And one of the remarkable things about the mind is that it has this self-healing ability. Strange, isn't it? Sometimes something happened to you at school. Maybe you were bullied. Or maybe you got a bad mark in an exam. Or maybe you got told off by a teacher. I don't know. I'm just imagining, because none of those things would ever happen to me at school. Only kidding. But all of those things happen on a somewhat regular basis. Now, my school reports would always say, Anthony seems to spend most of his time staring out the window. So all of those things that happen, and they're all gone. All those formative things, the traumas, the successes, imagine all the great things that's happened to you. First time you got a job, right? First time that you had a kid or got married or bought a house. Or for me, like the time that I got ordained. Amazing. All of these things you've done, all gone. So why do we think that it's our duty, our burden, to worry about these things? Why don't we just let them be? It's nice when things come to an end. So in meditation, we allow things to come to an end. When we do so, we start to notice that the real problem is something else entirely. The real problem is not that these bad things are present. That's all right. The real problem is that we're actually making more bad things. We're actually creating that anxiety. We're actually making that worry. We're actually reinforcing trauma that we've had by going back to those memories and worrying about them and bringing them up again and again. So it's not that there are things that are happening to us that we have to solve, but it's that we are creating things right now. We are little anxiety factories. We're worry factories. We're sitting there ready to produce these things at a moment's notice. And even in Dhamma practice, you can still bring that same mindset, you know? And you're like, oh, am I meditating right? How many people have asked me this? Oh, I'm doing this or that in meditation, is that correct? They're worried about whether they're doing the right thing in meditation. And so you bring these kinds of anxieties into it. So the purpose of meditation is not to do the right thing, it's to stop doing. And because, so this comes back to the problem of the self and self-identity. Because the reason that we can't stop doing these things is because we're attached to ourselves, we're attached to the idea of control. We want things to be a certain way. We keep making those things to be a certain way. Those ways are familiar, even if they're bad, right? At least they're familiar. At least it's us. we recognize, oh, that's me, I'm the worrier, I'm the anxious one, I'm the afraid one, I'm the nervous one, yeah? I'm the depressed one. That's who we are, that becomes who we are. We create that sense of self. And if that's not there, who are we? If we're not anxious, who are we? If we're not afraid, who are we? We'd rather be someone than to have to face that uncertainty. And so we keep on building up these things to reassure ourselves that we still exist. And underneath all of that, hiding underneath that fear is the fear that we're not going to exist anymore. If I disappear, what remains? Now, the tricky part here is that you're quite right. That fear is not an irrational one. Yeah? It's just irrational to be afraid of it. Because when we do meditate, we lose pieces of ourselves. Right? Someone once described an experience of enlightenment as being an experience of a part of themselves that they never knew existed was no longer there. Yeah. Part of you that you never knew existed and it's no longer there. But we kind of know what that's like in meditation, because this kind of insight happens in meditation. You're sitting there and maybe suddenly you feel this kind of anxiety or something, and then that anxiety goes away. And you can often reveal to yourself feelings or intentions, attitudes, thoughts that you're not really aware of. And you can sort of surprise yourself, I didn't know I thought like that. And it comes up and it's a part of who you are. And then that goes away. And it's shocking how empty you are. Because when all of those thoughts and beliefs and values go away, you're looking into your mind and there's just nothing there. It's weird. Now, what? But the surprising thing is, yes, it's kind of shocking, but it's also quite nice. You realize that holding on to that sense of self was what was creating all of these problems. And so this is why in meditation what we do is we gradually have to train our mind to see the ending of things as happiness. That's what we're doing when we're meditating. It's not about following a technique or getting it right or reaching some stages or doing any of these kinds of things. The real purpose of meditation is to train your mind, condition your mind to see the ending of things as happiness. And any time that you reach a deeper level of peace or a deeper level of insight in your meditation, that's because something has ended. And that's what you experience as peace, the ending of suffering. All right, let's do some meditation. Let's get out there and end some things. Or should I say, let's get in there and end some things. You're sitting quietly and making sure you feel comfortable in your body. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And whatever thoughts are going through your mind, just let them go. Come back to your breath. Whatever feelings you're experiencing, let them go. Come back to your breath. Whatever tension you feel in your body, just let it go. Come back to your breath. Let the breath be your teacher. Let the breath be your guide. Let the breath take away all of your sorrows. Let the breath restore your mind to health and happiness.
as the energies and activities in your body spill and cease, you find a sense of tranquility, almost a palpable sense of serenity will suffuse your body. Bringing you a kind of peace that you cannot know outside of meditation. Yes, I'm now coming near the end of the meditation. I want you to bring your mind back into the senses, into the sounds around you, and to just give yourself a moment and reflect back, looking at what's happened over the last 20 minutes of the meditation. Ask yourself, how did that go? What came to an end? What didn't come to an end? What is still left? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings find peace and awakening. Great timing. Thanks for that. Perfect. Okay, let's have a break for a few minutes. Have a cup of tea and then see you back for the talk. So, for my final Harris Park talk for the year, I wanted to continue to talk about cessation and ending, and give a bit of an overview of that topic from a Buddhist point of view. So, of course, Buddhism, as we all know, is a very weird religion, right? Weird for many reasons. Some people like to say it's not a religion. Okay, whatever. It's a religion for tax purposes. That's what matters. So people say it's not a religion because it doesn't have a god. Okay, fair enough. But it certainly fulfills most of the functions that a religion has in society, right? So it provides a moral code, there's an institutional structure, there's sacred scripture, there's a way of life or practice associated with it, there's certain beliefs and teachings associated with it, and so on. So it certainly sort of is similar to other religions in that way. But other religions tend to be based on positing, like the foundation of it tends to be based on the positing of some kind of metaphysical reality, aka God, usually. Usually God. There's something God. And then that immediately begins down a path where it's not just a sort of an incidental detail, but where like a fundamental part of that is something which is inherently unknowable. And this is where you sort of end up with that tension between religion as something that provides value for life and, say, science and empiricism, which are providing the facts of life. So in Buddhism, we don't really have that issue in that same way, because we don't begin Buddhism by talking about some kind of metaphysical reality. There's no kind of positive ontological state that we are positing in our Buddhist practice. Instead, we talk about the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the Buddha being a teacher, Dhamma being his teachings, the Sangha being those who follow his teachings. Nothing too weird about that, okay? It's just fairly pretty straightforward, actually. But the strange bits come to when you start to look at, well, what is the content of that teaching and that practice? So the Buddha is believed to have been the Buddha because of certain things that ended. And the way that the Buddha talks about his experience is always talking about his experience in terms of ending, the ending of suffering, the ending of defilements, the ending of rebirth. Yeah? So the Buddha is the one who brings these things to an end. And there's almost this irresistible desire to fill that gap. So we've got to say, well, there's got to be something. Right, it can't just be ending. As on and on and on, this debate that's been going for thousands of years. So let's have a bit of a look at what the Buddha meant when he talked about the ending of things, the cessation of things, or the kaya of things. So kaya is a very nice word in Pali, kshaya in Sanskrit. Kaya, I think, is unfortunately translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi as destruction. Asavakaya, the ending, the destruction of defilements. But it doesn't actually really mean defilements. Sorry, it doesn't really mean destruction. It's used in contexts like when you're traveling and you run out of food. Yeah, so running out of food. Or it's a context like, say, if the moon is waning. Yeah, the waning moon. Or if a stream is drying up. Yeah. None of these really sound like destruction, do they? Yeah. It's much more... right? It's a gradual and natural process where these things come to an end. Kaya. Yeah? So the evaporation of a stream or the using up of supplies or something like that, the waning of the moon. So the ending of things has this positive connotation in Buddhism. As I quoted from before, the meditation, Tesang Rupa Samo Sukho, this is the line that's taught when the Buddha passed away, the Buddha's Parinibbana. Anicca Vata Sankhara, alas, all things are impermanent. Upadavaya Dhammino, the nature's to rise and fall. Upajitva Nirujanti, having come up, they go away. Tesang Rupa Samo Sukho. And it's that last line that's a real kicker. And passing is bliss. Yeah? One of the many strange things about Buddhism as a religion is that, of course, we have, you know, we perform the change of life rituals that are done in most religious practices, including funeral services. When we do a funeral service, we often recite that same verse that was recited at the Buddha's funeral. Okay? Makes sense, except then we're kind of saying to all of the relatives, oh, now that they're gone, yeah, well, now we're happy that they're gone. I mean, this is literally what it means. Yeah, Tesang Vupa Samo Sukho. Right? I mean, technically, of course, what it's referring to is Parinibbana, not to actually just death. It's referring to Parinibbana. But it's recited in the funeral case, so we sort of lose that context. And in Thailand, then, so because of that, sankhara takes on the meaning of like a body. And so it's like, oh, the body's passed away. But it doesn't really mean that. It means the conditioned phenomenon, all the things that's changing and conditioned in the world. But still, it's a strange thing to say, isn't it, right? When your beloved teacher passes away. Tesang Rupa Samo Sukho, the ending of all of those conditions is bliss. It's a bit, almost a bit distasteful, isn't it? Yeah? It's a bit challenging. Yeah, it should be. Yeah, sorry, Dipika. Sorry? Yes? For them, right? Yeah. That's right, the distilling of them in that line, Tesang, is the sankharas. So the sankharas have stilled. So for the one who's passed, who's Parinibbana, yeah, for him is sukha. Yeah. Yeah. Now this teaching on Nibbana and on cessation would be... philosophically challenging and stimulating as a teaching. But the Buddha wasn't just about giving us challenging ideas to play with, right? He was about showing us a path to peace, a path to happiness. And so this teaching on cessation is not really meant as a kind of a metaphysical kind of football that we can kick around and argue about the real meaning of cessation and Nibbana and so on and so forth. The Buddha was notoriously simple in the way that he talked about these things. So rather than worry too much about what the meaning and the definition of these highest things are, then the Buddha wanted us to put more effort into, or more focus on, looking at what are those things that lead to cessation. You know, and it's kind of funny where, you know, now we have the online and the interwebs, and we have endless discourse on Nibbana and on Brahma and on the nature of the metaphysics and God and all of these kinds of things, and it goes on and on and on and on. And although that cessation never seems to end, somehow. And look, it's good to talk about these things and clarify your ideas and so on, yeah? But at the same time, put it into perspective. It's unlikely, I'm just saying, statistically speaking, it's unlikely that you're going to be the one that's going to figure out the true meaning of Nibbana after all these years, okay? And maybe you are, okay? But it seems like, if I was going to make a bet, statistically speaking, if I were a betting man, and like the idea that, you know, so many people seem to like to say, oh, you know, Nibbana is the same as God, or it's different to God, or it's the same as Brahman, or what Nisargadatta was teaching, this is the same as the Buddha's Nibbana, or these kinds of things. I'm like, I've been practicing Dhamma for a long time. Yeah? And my path is to try to realize what the Buddha's teachings. And every day I'm confronted with the abject reality of how little I understand of the Buddha's teachings and how much I have to learn. And to think that I can stand above the Buddha's teachings, judge what he said, judge what some other great spiritual teacher said, judge what a third philosophy said, and then be able to confidently assert that I know whether they're all the same or how they're the same and different. It seems that there are few people in history who've been able to do that. By few, I mean none. Maybe if the Buddha was here, he could do it. Yeah? I don't know, but we need to have some humility in our spiritual path. Yeah? We need to have some humility. The Buddha wasn't too worried about you getting the correct definition of these things. He was much more interested in whether you were actually peaceful. Now, each step in the Buddha's path is framed and presented as a kind of cessation. If you, let's say, take a precept on not killing. So to not killing means you're refraining from killing. You're not doing that bad act. You're not doing the act of stealing. So each of the precepts is a not doing of something. Which means that the precepts themselves don't tell you how to live. Right? I mean, you can be keeping the precepts and do all kinds of things and live all kinds of lives. Yeah? But they share that thing in common, the thing that you're not doing. Yeah? It's the not doing of those things that makes the keeping of the precepts. And when we come to meditation, I won't go into all of the different aspects of the path, it would take too long, but when we come to meditation, then we start to double down on this cessation. In fact, the course of meditation, like the different meditation jhanas and so on, is called an anupubha nirodha, a gradual cessation. Yeah. Again, this is like an inversion of what you might normally think meditation is, right? So a normal religion might say, oh, when you're meditating, you're coming into contact with a greater reality. Right? You're actually seeing something which is more than. Yeah? The Buddha says you're seeing something which is less than. Yeah? I mean, it's still more than from a certain respect. You know, don't take any of these things as being absolute. You know, when you're developing meditation, of course you are developing new positive qualities as well. Right? It's not that there's nothing there, right, during that process. But an important part of the way of looking at it is in terms of cessation. So for deep meditation, we call absorptions or jhanas, the essential prerequisite is the cessation of the five hindrances, which are...
Craving.
started out great.
Restlessness
and remorse, yeah?
Remorse.
Sloth and torpor.
Doubt.
Excellent. Very good. Thanks for that. All right, so five hindrances. So these are the things, they're hindrances because they stop us from getting into meditation. And the word hindrance in Pali has kind of a slightly dual meaning. It means the things that's going to stop you, it means a hindrance, but it also means the things that will shroud you or endarken you. Right? It's almost like something that's going to wrap you around. Actually, the root of it comes from Vritra, the cosmic serpent, who was like literally the constrictor. So he would constrict you, which both stops you from doing things, hence being a hindrance, but also wraps you in darkness. And as we meditate, those hindrances come to an end. And that darkness, the presence of that darkness, comes to an end. Right? The presence of darkness comes to an end. And we experience that in meditation as the manifestation of light. And the deeper we go in meditation, the more light that our mind appears. And when we're doing this in shallow meditation, when we're just starting out, that light's more just like a state of mind, or it's just something you say, oh yeah, I feel, you know, my mind feels bright, or my mind feels clear, or something like that. You know, there's a sense of light about it, right? A sense of lightness about it. But then as you go deeper, you see there's like an actual light, you know, and it feels like the sun. It feels like someone's just turned the lights on in your brain. And it feels like the ending of those hindrances, like the passing away of that darkness, was something that was, from a certain point of view, that darkness was like a fog or a presence that was wrapping and clouding and stopping the mind from manifesting its light. And so that cloud of darkness comes to an end. That's what you're experiencing when you're meditating. When you're meditating at the end of the meditation, if your mind feels more clear than at the beginning, that's why. It's because you've let go of the hindrances, at least a little bit. Huh? And your mind, therefore, is more clear. You can think more clearly. You can feel more clearly. The way your mind works is more clear. The deeper we go into meditation, then the more these hindrances will fade away. And the thing about the hindrances, of course, is that we think we know what they are. Of course, we do know what they are to some extent. But as we go along, they come up in more and more and more subtle forms. And we can see them in more and more subtle forms. So at a certain point, let's take sloth and torpor, for example. So sloth and torpor might be just feeling sleepy. Well, initially, sloth and torpor is, nah, I don't really feel like meditating. Right? That's the first one that's going to stop you from actually meditating. And then the next one, you sit down to meditate, and you're like, oh, I'm sleepy. Maybe I'll stop, yeah? And then maybe even if you keep going, but then your mind feels dull and drowsy, right? And that's the kind of next one. So these are kind of progressively more subtle forms of sloth and torpor. But then when your meditation goes, your mind might feel very bright, and then the sloth and torpor will come in much more subtle ways. Yeah? And it will trick you, because sloth and torpor is a tool of Mara. Mara likes to trick you. Why? Because Mara wants you to die. That's who Mara is. Mara is death. It wants you to die, and when you listen to it, that's what you're listening to. So Mara will come along and tell you, it's such a good meditation, you know? nice, yeah. Oh, it's good. No notes. Yeah, keep going. That's great. Yeah, so, you know, no need to, like, be aware of, you don't need to, like, be so mindful of the breath because, you know, you don't want to push it too much, so you're not going to be mindful of your breath anymore. You're just going to enjoy the peace of that mind. So this is sloth and torpor. Yeah? Your mind is telling you, oh, I don't need to actually do the meditation. I'm just going to sit here and just kind of surf on the feeling. Right? I'm just going to enjoy that nice feeling that I've had.
but you're not actually doing the application of mind that's going to deepen your meditation. Or another one which Mara likes to do, which is another subtle form of perhaps sloth and torpor, or perhaps a bit of restlessness as well, is that you meditate, your mind will get a certain depth and so on, and then you'll be like, oh, you know, my mind's peaceful, I should now switch to insight meditation, right? So I'm now going to go to insight meditation, I'm going to do that, yeah? So what does that mean? What that means is your mind will never really abandon the hindrances, because as soon as you get peaceful, you're going to stop getting more peaceful, and you're going to start being more active with your mind, yeah? Do not get into that habit. It's a bad habit. Yes, you should develop insight meditation, and there are ways of meditating that use your mind in a more active way. But don't get into the trap of meditating, getting kind of modicum of peace, and then thinking, oh, now I'm going to do some insight. Bad idea. Yeah? What you do is you meditate for one meditation, doing samatha meditation, making mind peaceful. Another meditation, do insight meditation. Right? Don't get into that trap. Or alternatively, if you have a meditation where your mind goes into a deep state of peace in the meditation, then the mind by itself, when the hindrances have gone, withdraws from the meditation, and it's had enough of doing that, then you can go and do insight meditation, right? But that's afterwards. It's after you've gone to that state of deep peace, not beforehand, because then you'll never get to that state of deep peace. You'll get to a shallow peace. Yeah, this is Mara. This is a subtle kind of Mara. These are the tricks that Mara uses to stop your meditation from getting deep. So you need to keep things ceasing. So what Mara is doing is Mara is playing on this subtle fear of not existing. That's why you're so susceptible to it. You want to feel something. You want to taste something. You want to have something. You want to be something. And Mara's job is very easy. Mara just needs to make the most subtle suggestion in your mind, and you'll be like, yeah, that sounds very reasonable. Yes, yes. Yeah. So just remember the Dhamma, and remember, stick to it. Have that determination. Stick to your meditation and let things cease. And the more that things cease in your meditation, the more peaceful you can get. And I promise you that if you persist and if you don't let yourself get waylaid, then you will experience deeper and deeper peace in a way that you never knew was possible. You think you know what peace is, but you don't. You just have a vague idea, yeah? And then when you experience it, you're like, wow, that's amazing. But then that peace is nothing compared to the next level of peace that keeps on going deeper and deeper and deeper. And this is that gradual cessation. This is how, if we follow that training, we overcome that conditioning to be afraid that our self will vanish. Right? Because each step we go, a bit of our self vanishes. And it's okay. It's all right. Initially, it might be the angry mind, the hating mind, and that vanishes. And we're like, oh, that's okay. It's actually like a lot better now that that's gone. Yeah, that's terrific. And we realize we don't actually have to be attached to those kind of angry thoughts. But then it might be something that's more subtle as well. Right? Something might be more subtle. And then we can let go of that. Maybe that more subtle thing might be, say, a sense of control in our meditation, that we feel like we're the one who's directing the meditation. Right? It's a kind of subtle thing that comes up, and then we can let go of that. And we're like, oh, yeah, that's peaceful. So the more we go down in the meditation, the more that more subtle things will cease. But one thing to notice is that in meditation, and in the mind generally, subtle does not mean weak. Yeah, subtle does not mean weak. Subtle actually is the opposite. The things that are subtle are the things that are really powerful, because they underlie all of those coarse things that are happening. And so we notice the coarse things, right? These are just usually short-lived manifestations, right? But the underlying tendencies, right? The fundamental things that are going on, these, when you see them, they're so small. Yeah? so small, so just hardly anything to it. So you keep on going and you keep on learning sadha, learning faith in cessation, learning to trust that process, learning to trust that as things come to an end, it will be okay. Yeah. It's normal that as this happens, that at certain times you will be afraid. Right? It happens. Why are we afraid? Because part of you is coming to an end. And this is like the fundamental fear. It's not an incidental detail, right? This is the fundamental fear that we're going to end, that we're facing in meditation. So this is going to be revealed as we deepen the meditation, like peeling off an onion. Yeah? And that fear is there at every step of the way. Every step of the way. Every step of the way. So there's that dual process where on the one hand we are facing our fears, letting go of parts of ourselves that we're attached to, but on the other hand we're being reassured by the process itself. When we do that, it feels good. It's nice when that ends. And so we're constantly being reassured. This is how we learn to understand cessation. Yeah? So cessation is not something to be understood through resolving a metaphysical debate. Cessation is something to be experienced through the process of meditation. Now, each of the stages in the jhanas experiences the cessation. Cessation of first of all the hindrances, and then vitakka vichara, and then piti sukha, rapture and bliss, and then just bliss is left, and bliss ends, and you just have equanimity in the fourth jhana, right? And then perceptions of form disappear. So in that case, in the jhana, the form jhanas, the form in form jhanas means basically means the nimitta, the light that you're experiencing. That's what the form is. The form is like an inner perception of material properties, such as light. Light is a physical property. Okay, so form doesn't mean literal physical matter, but it means an inner perception of those material properties. So in the form meditations, you still perceive a light or some kind of physical or material dimension as perceived from inside. But in the formless meditations, that goes. That's why they're called formless meditations. So now there's just perception of infinite space. And then you let go and you're not perceiving infinite space anymore. It's just infinite consciousness. And then it's not even just infinite consciousness, it's nothingness. But even the perception of nothingness is still the perception of nothingness. So then you're like neither perception nor non-perception. Yeah, it's kind of not quite there, but not quite not there. And then perception itself ceases, the cessation of perception of feeling. And in Nibbana, Parinibbana, everything ceases. Sabbasankhara samatha, yeah, the cessation of all conditions, and what we call Nibbana. Sabbasankhara samatha. And so there is something deeply mysterious about that. Yeah? There should be. It's mysterious. There's something deeply scary about this. Yeah? There should be. Yeah? There's something deeply incomprehensible about it. There should be. Yeah? And we shouldn't try to kind of minimize or explain away how radical and how disturbing this goal of Nibbana is. Nor should we try to reinterpret it in a way that makes us feel good about ourselves. Right? Because what that means, what happens when you do that is it means that I, in my desperately unenlightened state, fueled by my fears and anxieties, am now going to change what the Buddha talked about Nibbana so that it fits my beliefs, so that I don't feel too disturbed by it. You might just detect that there's one or two problems with that approach. The main one being that you're never going to get anywhere because you've just determined that your spiritual practice is actually just there to make you feel good about yourself.
spiritual, the goal of spiritual practice and the goal of cessation should be disturbing. Yeah, it should be disturbing. And if it's not challenging you, yeah, then what's the point? Yeah. But also, don't let it become overwhelming, right? Don't let it become overwhelming. Just put it into perspective. It's not about, okay, I'm going to just switch all the lights off or whatever and not be. It's about, I'm going to watch my breath and let these hateful thoughts come to an end. And then I'll let the next thing come to an end. And then I'll let the next thing come to an end. And then I'll let the next thing come to an end. Okay? And when you do that anubhubha nirodha, that gradual cessation, if at any point you want to pull out, you can do that. Yeah? It's okay. If you decide, no, actually, cessation's boring. I'd rather have things. That's all right. It's okay. Yeah. But what you probably will find if you do it properly is that at each point you realize this delightful peace that comes from cessation. And you realize that we are just compulsively filling our mind and filling our lives with things just so we can feel something. When we learn to trust cessation, it is so liberating. Honestly, it's so liberating to have that feeling that you want something. Right? But then, oh, well, I can't get it. Oh, well, now I'm going to be upset because I can't get the thing that I want. Right? But to imagine that once you see it from a perspective of cessation, you think, oh, well, now I can't get that thing that I want. Oh, well, it's probably better. Probably wasn't all that great. Now I don't have to worry about it. Now I don't have to spend my money. Now I don't have to spend my time. I don't have to do that thing. I can just be peaceful. And you're so freed. Imagine that. Imagine any situation that you get into and you can think, oh, no matter how stressful, how dangerous, how scary, how bad that is, even if it's the end of your life, you know, or the loss of a loved one, then you can see that and think, ah, we'll come to an end, actually. It's just another cessation. And so then we are seeing the deep truth of Buddhism, not through a metaphysical construct, but through the everyday reality. We see it in the leaves that fall from the tree. We see it in the meal that comes to an end. We see it in the empty gas tank in your car. You see it in your empty bank balance at the end of the month. You think, oh, that's ceased as well. Come to an end. Pushing up the daisies, pining for the fjords. You get it, right? Nicola gets it. So it's such a powerful perspective to train ourselves in. Now, the year is coming to an end. I don't know what your experience is, but my experience is that as you get older, the years get shorter, right? I feel like it's January or something, and I'm looking back and thinking, what happened? Where did that go? And you know, usually at the end of the year, it's time to take stock of what's happened in the year. And we can think of all the things that we've done. But maybe this year, instead of thinking all the things we've done in the year, we could think of all of the things we haven't done. It'd be a very long list. Imagine all those things you haven't done this year. I haven't gone to the moon. I haven't gone to Mars. I haven't gone to Venus. I haven't gone to the asteroid belt. I mean, even that's a long list, right? All the places in space that I haven't gone to. And that's just getting started. So all of those things that we haven't done, but particularly all of those bad and harmful things that we haven't done, right? How much killing have you done this year? Anyone here been on a murder spree in the last 12 months? Huh? All good. No, it's not too bad, is it? Certainly better than being on a murder spree. Yeah. So think about all of those things that we've done, all those times we chose to give life rather than to kill, all of the times we chose to be honest, all those times we chose to let things go, all those times we chose to be kind, to be generous, to help others. Yeah. Just remember all of these things that we've done in that year. And this is, in a way, we've become less than we were. Less of all the bad stuff anyway, hopefully. Anyway, so this is a little talk for you today on cessation for the end of the year. And hopefully you will cease even more. And look forward to some of you I will see at the retreat over Christmas. So that'll be wonderful. For those of you who I won't see over the retreat over Christmas, then it's been lovely seeing you through this time and our friends all over the world. And it's been wonderful to see you and share some Dhamma with you for this period. And so hopefully we'll see you again next year. Have a question here from Eddie. What is the right effort we can do to let regret as one of the hindrances cease? Okay, so regret comes from something that's either been done or not done. And so I guess there's a dual kind of path there. So the first thing is that in many cases, there's nothing really that we can do about it, right? Something that's in the past or something like that. And so we just have to learn to let go of it in meditation. But there will be some cases also where regrets are more kind of active or more present, and then that's something that you can do something about. That might be particularly when it comes to ethical things, like say if you get in an argument or you do something wrong or something like that, and you feel that sense of regret, especially if it's something which is active and worrying you and so on, then go and solve it. Yeah, go talk to that person, or go to find that problem and fix it and solve the problem, and take the effort to bring that attention to an end. Sometimes regret is more kind of nebulous. Regret often manifests as like a projection of some kind of loss or some kind of feeling of lack inside ourselves. So we may be like regretting, say, something that we haven't done, right? So you might feel regret, I wish I'd meditated more, or wish I'd done this, or wish I'd done that. And so, in a sense, we're sort of projecting our own feeling of inadequacy or insecurity or something like that into these regrets. So if there's something that you can do to improve that, if it's a good thing that you regret not doing, then do that good thing. Yeah? Undertake the, give yourself some encouragement, remind yourself that regret feels bad. This is important, right? Remember that. It doesn't mean like rolling around in it, okay? You don't have to just get stuck in it, but just reflect on it. Say to yourself, oh yeah, what does that regret feel like? It feels bad. You know? Why are you feeling that? Yeah. Ask yourself, would the Buddha want me to feel this? Did the Buddha want me to feel bad? Of course not. The Buddha wanted you to be happy. Yeah. So why don't you have the understanding and you have the capacity to do something different next time. So let's do that. Huh? In the Vinaya with the Sangha, we always say Sangari Sami whenever we've done something wrong. And then we always say, thank you for letting us know. Thank you for telling us. I will be better. I'll do better in the future. Sangari Sami. Yes. As our Pali students will know, Sangari Sami, the future tense, future first person indicative tense. I shall do better has a strong sense. I shall do better in the future. Yes. Okay. So Letty asks, thank you, Bhante. Well, my pleasure, Letty. Thank you. If the fear of death becomes very overwhelming in meditation, how should we respond? Well, yes, that can happen, right? As usual with these things, the answer you'll get from me is depends. And yeah, I mean, I can't really sort of tell people what to do in meditation because I'm not in your meditation, believe it or not. And your meditation is your meditation. It's not my meditation, right? First thing I would say is that if the fear of death becomes overwhelming in meditation, just sit there. Don't do anything. Just be overwhelmed. Yeah? And if it means that you're going to be crying and you're going to be curling up into a ball and sobbing and all of these things, then do that. That's fine. That's okay. Yeah? And just let that fear come and just be as mindful as you can through that process. Because why does that fear come? Usually, these things happen in meditation because our minds are like little apartments and they have like doors and walls between them, and all the different parts of our mind are locked off from each other. And when we meditate, we're kind of, oh, I might just peek into that room that I haven't looked into since I was like 4 years old or something like that, right? And then somehow maybe a monster leaps out. And in fact, that is in fact the monster that was under your bed when you were 4 years old. Right? And that kind of thing can happen. And so, but this just happens naturally. It's not like you're deliberately doing this in meditation. It's just how it works. It's just like your mind's just structured. Your mind has this structure and so on. And then in meditation, those structures become a bit more fuzzy, a bit more loose. Your mind becomes more open. Yeah? And so these fears and so on can manifest, and it's okay. And you begin to realize, that's such an important realization. That, oh, yeah, I really am afraid of death. And maybe we can lock it down, right? So we can lock it down fairly successfully much of the time. But then right at that point, it's come back to you. So that's actually good. Yeah, you have the wisdom, you realize, that's how deeply I am terrified of death. So this is good. So this is normally the thing. Now, the rule of thumb is that if at the end of the meditation you more or less get it together and can go back with life, then you're probably fine. Okay? But if you can't, then you may be not fine. Right? So if you find that fear of death is then overwhelming you and oppressing you outside of the meditation, right, and you can't stop thinking about it, and it's starting to affect your mood and so on and so forth, then this is a sign that there's maybe something deeper going on, something more problematic or something like that, in which case find somebody to talk to about it. And, you know, tell somebody, even just people in your family or friends or whatever, who can give you some support, and then get some feedback and just to see, you know, what's actually happening with that, right? And so you might need to do something about that if that's the case. Maybe, you know, talk to someone or something like that. So that's the rule of thumb. If it's a problem and it's more or less stays in your meditation, then it's usually okay, right? And sometimes these things will come over a period of time, right? So you might find that it might even be like over several weeks or several months, that feeling will keep coming back to you in meditation, right? And you have to keep just being patient and being mindful and just go through that process. Yeah. All right. So I think it's probably about time to wrap up for this evening. Thanks so much, everybody, for your attention. I think we don't have any announcements. Is that right? I think for once we don't have any announcements just yet. Thanks for all those who've been supporting us through the last year. For those, I'll see you on Wednesday or over the retreat, and look forward to seeing you there. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you back at Monks in Space on, well, mid-January sometime. Okay, thank you so much. Be happy, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.